Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wonder what kind of musical instrument leaves out the kind of sound.
That goes. Oh no. Yeah, there's not. It's difficult to think of a good example. But maybe like a kind of a, you know, bagpipe player in an open moor where there's no reflection. The bagpipe would tend to give sound out.
Yeah, but not like guitar.
No, there'll always be some kind of angular dependent. Let me just log out of here and then the guy can. Yeah, so no instrument would give out totally isotropic sound. There'll always be some kind of directionality, so it's always an approximation.
So that's that formula for intensity where we have power over the area of sphere.
Yeah.
So that formula works for even
non-isotropic. Yeah, that only applies to an isotropic one. You can approximate most instruments to be isotropic.
So we just assume that, and then we just use that formula.
Yeah. If you, as long as you stay assuming that sound is isotropic, you should
bear on that. That's an approximation, but yeah.
But to actually do questions based upon, you know, dealing with the whole angular dependence of the sound would be quite complicated. So, yeah. Okay, thanks. Hiya.
For the
podcast, yeah.
What's like the minimum amount of words you have?
It kind of depends. Certainly a maximum is 2,000, but typically, I mean, you're going to probably do at least 1,000 words, that kind of range, yeah. But if you're concise in writing, you don't need to write as much.
Yeah,
you can do, you can just look at all the stuff we've got and then just kind of like pick up on anything that you like and kind of, yeah, you can compare one instrument to another, you can look at, you know, what you have on there, the same instrument, compare different instruments, look at the, yeah, just, yeah.
I would like to ask you,
Oh, right, you didn't get a handout on the...
Yeah, they have a...
Right. Okay, yeah. The both of them are usually handed out on a Monday and the Monday lecture, so I'll back. And if you come here, I'll just print you one at the back. Okay. Is that okay? Okay.
I didn't find that.
Oh, right, yeah. I wonder if people are taking... There should have been enough for everyone, but maybe they've kind of...
It's going to be
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Three different times in the lectures.
That clock is a clock on the computer, and it's real time when they're all different.
Yeah. Because it's not fixed.
Yeah.
Yes, it's called me out.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm back. Sorry, that's my water, yes. Thank you. All right, let's get started. So, apologies for the late start of our lecture. We'll get this clock here fixed eventually, so people kind of know when lectures are supposed to finish. All right, so the beginning of this course is kind of whistle-stop tour through different languages. So you had MIPS assembly in 1 week. Now, obviously, two lectures is not enough time to learn MIPS. So as I emailed around, there is this online lab that you can do and should do. And then coming up in a week's time, there will be an assignment on programming in MIPS using this SPIM MIPS simulator. So it's well worth doing the lab now because that will get you up to speed, ready for when the practical itself starts. Now, there will be lab assistance. I'm hoping to get the lab started next week. It's taking us a bit of time still to get the demonstrators recruited and getting the times all settled, but we'll get that kind of all arranged. Let me just try just kind of surveying different times with you for labs, just to kind of get a rough idea of what times are good, what aren't. So in previous years, I think we found Wednesday afternoons are good times for labs. Is that generally true? I see nods. Is it? Are there people here for whom Wednesday afternoons are bad? Okay. So this would be one time. Now, what we can do is we can set up labs different times of week, which are good for different people. So for those of you for whom Wednesday afternoons are bad, what kind of times through the week are better or are good? They can be just kind of 1 hour slots or 2 hour slots, depending on demand.
Can we have a 2 o'clock any day before the 3? Because you still have a 2 p.m. ending from 2 to 3, right? Any day.
Okay, so here, call for.
Not Tuesday.
2 o'clock, but not Tuesday. So especially for those for whom Wednesday afternoons are bad, is it? Sorry? Wednesday afternoon is bad?
For me, yes.
Okay, so maybe I don't know, 2 o'clock on the Thursday or Friday, is that? Sorry? 2 o'clock on Tuesday?
Yes.
Monday. All right. Right, let's go for just surveys for 2 o'clock. So 2 o'clock Monday. Okay, okay. So I don't know. That's 15. 2 o'clock Tuesday. Not many. All right, let's scrap that. 2 o'clock Thursday. So I'm kind of seeing 10, 12, to 2 o'clock Friday. It's maybe about 8, 9. Somebody likes 2 o'clock Friday. Okay. I'll check which labs are free as well, because it kind of depends on. And what's going to happen is we'll have, kind of ticking over every week, we'll have at least 2 hours a week, so perhaps one on a Wednesday. Well, maybe to space things out, we'll take this Monday slot. So let me check. If we have something 2 o'clock Monday and then something on Wednesday, is there anybody here who can't make either of those times? All right, there are still... So for those of you who can't make either of those times, what are the times you can make? So Friday, can you all make Friday 2 o'clock?
Thursday 2 o'clock is great.
Thursday 2 o'clock, great. I see lots of shakes of heads there. It seems like an impossible task. So for those of you for whom these two are bad, what are good times? Just name me some times. Thursday at 2. So... Sounds like we should maybe try to do all three of these slots.
How long do they run for? Is it 1 hour or 2 hours?
If we do three slots, it would be just 1 hour each. But what would happen would be, typical behavior in previous years probably will be the same this year, is we give you at least a two-week window for assignments, but typically, people don't do work for the assignments until about 3 days before the deadline. Every other lecturer says, start things early, and please still try to start things early. But in practice, I guess maybe three days before deadline, people start hitting problems. They get far enough into a practical. They realize that things are not going as planned, and maybe they're panicking, and they need help. But anyway, suddenly the labs start filling up a lot 3 days before a deadline. So what I've done is I've laid on in the past, say, just 2 or 3 hours of demonstrate of lab hours each week. And there might be only just one demonstrator on duty, and usually that's been enough. But then in the run-up to labs, 2 or 3 days before, I'll give you perhaps a lab every day at 5, and put on two demonstrators or even three demonstrators on the night before. And that seems to kind of fit better with the practical work patterns that many of you actually follow. So that's the kind of support I'll give you, unless I hear kind of huge uproar at that and hear ideas from you for something else. Okay, so that's probably how we'll plan it. But I'll see if I can otherwise have a kind of some pattern like this. So for these 3 days, Wednesday afternoon, Thursday, and Monday at 2, is there anybody who can't make any of those? So all of you can make at least one of those three times. That's looking good. Sorry, I saw a shake of the head. There's somebody who can't make any of these three times?
That's a joke.
One of you. Thursday morning. All I can say is, there's only so many sessions a week I can put on. But kind of in the run-up to, as I said, in the run-up to deadlines, usually at 5 o'clock, it's not a terribly proper time because people want to go home, but usually there aren't too many classes at 5. And so if I do classes at 5 for 3 or 4 days and run up to a homework, would that work at least for you? Okay, so at least it'll have those slots. Good. And also I should mention that I've not made any song and dance about this yet, but there's a online discussion forum for the class. If you go to the webpage, there's a link to a discussion forum. So any time of the week, day or night, you're free to ask questions there. Obviously, if you're asking for help on homework, you can't ask, well, what's the answer to this part? But if the kind of thing, general things you're getting stuck on, like how do I get this SPIM simulator working? What does this confusing error message mean? Feel free to ask those kind of questions on that discussion group. So I will have at least one of the demonstrators watching that discussion group every day, checking in every day to give you prompt answers, or I'll be in there as well as necessary. And also, if you too are viewing the discussion forum And you can answer somebody else's question. Feel free to jump in as well and make your contribution. That will be another way for you to get feedback between lab sessions, especially on practical stuff, but on actually anything else too that comes up in the lectures in the class. Alrighty, let's get started on today's lecture. So as I said, we had a week just on MIPS. You'll have the practical too in the lab to kind of help you more to get to grips with the kind of skeleton theory that I've given you. Today and next Tuesday, what we're going to be doing is a lightning introduction to the C language. This is not going to turn you into expert C programmers, but it's going to start to give you a flavor of what C is all about. And later in the semester, we're going to be doing a second practical, which combines some C programming with also improving your understanding of CPU architecture. So we kind of combine two learning objectives into one, helping you practice some C and learning about architectures as well. So you'll get a chance to kind of practice what we're hearing about here, but you'll also, I encourage you now to take kind of what you have heard here and just try writing a few simple C programs. I'll give you enough that you'll be able to go out there and compile a program and just try a few things out. And but there are textbooks as well. There are C books on reserve. There are umpteen C resources on the net as well. There's some which are linked to, for example, from the schedule webpage for the course. All right, let's get stuck into the material itself. So, intro slide. We call C a high-level language and a low-level language. So what do we mean? High-level, it's not MIPS, it's not assembly code, and it incorporates many of the features that you've seen in the Java high-level language. So kind of all the control structures, ideas of functions or methods, and it's got ideas a bit like classes, but more primitive. So it's a high-level language in that sense, but we say it's a low-level language as well because, unlike Java, it gives you much more exposure to the raw bits and bytes and words in memory. And so it's a very good language for doing systems programming. If you look at the languages that most kind of operating systems are coded in these days, most of them will use kind of 80-90% C, and then maybe the critical parts will be coded in assembly. But people don't generally code very much in assembly because it's very, very laborious and tedious. And only if you really care about efficiency or, I don't know, there's just some incredibly grungy manipulation, low-level CPU-level manipulation you've got to do, which you can't access from C. Only in situations like that would you actually resort to diving down and programming in assembly. All right, so yeah, hit the second bullet. Also, too, you might program in C if you really care about performance. You might use it as opposed to, say, Java. And we'll discuss in a couple of slides' time about why you get that better performance. I'm not going to be presenting C to you from scratch, so I'm going to assume that you all know Java and be really kind of trying to focus on what are the differences from Java. So maybe a few of you, hopefully most of you, all of you have seen some Java already or are learning Java very quickly, so this will all make some sense. If you haven't seen Java, then hopefully some other language you've seen at least introduces you to some similar concepts that will kind of allow the vocabulary I'm using to make some sense to you. Fortunately, the designers of Java, when they realized that C was already a popular language when they were working on Java, and they chose to make a lot of the syntax similar to C. So a lot of the syntax you're actually going to see, well, a lot of the syntax you know from Java actually has been borrowed in the first place from C, which is going to make learning C that much easier. And particularly, the syntax for things like statements and expressions is very similar. Or actually, even I say they're the same. Very similar, I think I'd say. That's more accurate. All right. So, outline. This is over two lectures. Let me just dive in. So the next few slides are kind of high-level overview of what makes it different from Java. So C, for start, is not object-oriented. So what do we mean by this? You've seen Java object-oriented language based around classes. And your Java program is kind of a collection of classes. Inside those classes, you've got methods. A C program really is structured as collections of functions, which are very much like Java methods, although unlike in Java, where the method's always associated with a class, in a C program, the functions are more they're more naked, they're more kind of sitting by themselves, they're not directly associated with a class or a set of objects. In addition, when we say it's not object-oriented, we don't have all these fancy things that you see in Java, like inheritance, when you define one class inheriting fields and members from some parent class, when you have this subtyping relationship and between objects in some class, some parent class, and objects in some child class. And you don't have what's called dynamic dispatch. Now, actually, let me check. So when we talk about programming languages, we bandy around these terms, subtyping and dynamic dispatch. So does subtyping make sense to all of you? For anybody, does it not make sense? Quite a few, okay. And dynamic dispatch? Quite a few, okay, all right. Good, but not good, but... So these are really just kind of... If you were to kind of open a book which really explained what object-oriented programming and features are all about, you'd see these terms there. You've probably seen them, but maybe don't know what they are by name. So something like subtyping is probably a bit easier. I'll just kind of give you a flavor of that. That's when you've got a class A and you... Did you do a tiny bit of UML last year? Are you doing it this year? Yeah. Okay, so in UML you might draw something like a class diagram like this, which just says I've got a class B and it's inheriting from class A. Did you do inheritance in Java? Okay. So I've got a class B, which is in a class A, then what subtyping is saying is it's saying if I've got a... So what subtyping means is that we say that the class B as a type is a subtype of the class A. What that means is all the objects which we can consider to be of type B can also be considered to be of type A. And so there's this kind of classic example. We say A is something like the class of all shapes. And so we can design a class for shapes. And maybe we've got methods for printing shapes or collecting shapes together. And then we can have subclasses, which are things like rectangles and circles and squares and diamonds and so on. And then when we've got the subtyping, we're saying that every object which is a diamond object is also a shape object. So in a nutshell, that's what this concept of subtyping is all about. And what I'm saying here is, in C, we don't have that. All right, C is not interpreted. So in Java, as hopefully was explained, when you compile a Java program to Java bytecode, that bytecode then runs on what's called a virtual machine. There's a program which behaves as a virtual CPU, which reads the bytecode and actually executes it. That's in the kind of most simple story about Java. In the C world, your program is directly translated down to machine code of a particular processor family. So it's translated down to x86 assembly code or down to code for this ARM processor I was mentioning before. And because you're translating all the way down there, you get generally programs which run faster than their Java counterparts. Now, of course, in the Java program world, as you might know, there are these things called just-in-time compilers, which actually will take your Java code, which is normally interpreted, and we'll figure out while it's running some critical parts of it, and will actually compile those critical parts for you so they run much faster. So the performance difference isn't as great as you might initially imagine you might get. I mean, originally C ran maybe 10 times faster than Java, and now maybe it's, I don't know, a factor of two slower. There are other factors too in Java which make it slower, different from the fact that it's interpreted, but we won't talk about those right now. All right, but generally, if you want performance, you write in C is a kind of often a language of choice. All right, C is a much less safe language. So in Java, you've probably got quite familiar with exceptions, and when your program isn't working quite right, exceptions get thrown. Now, you might find these exceptions a real pain, but believe me, they're actually rather nice for you. So in C, very often there'll be things that happen which are bad, and your C program will just keep on running happily as if nothing ever happened. So you might do a divide by zero. You might do might try to access an element of an array at an index, which actually isn't even in the array, is beyond the upper bounds of the array. And in C, you do that, and you access some other data structure in memory, and just you read in that data, your program sees the value and just keeps on going. And this is infuriating from a program's point of view, because you think you see this very mysterious data appearing and you don't know where it comes from. You don't know why there's a problem. Whereas in Java, an exception at least may help you narrow down where your problem is. And then when a C program does crash, it kind of crashes in a pretty bad way. So kind of it's more difficult programming well in C because more trust is placed on the programmer. And we'll see kind of through today and tomorrow, so today and next time, examples of this. All right, continuing talking about the differences. So what we call memory management is different. So in Java, did you talk about different memory areas at all? Did you talk about the concept of the heap and the stack and static areas? No, okay, let's go, because this is brand new material then. All right. So this is behind the scenes, even in Java. So when you're writing a program, you're manipulating data in memory, and there are really three areas that data is held in. One area is called the heap. Whenever you said new class name, you asked for a new object. The memory for that object was allocated in a region of memory called the heap. Another area is the program stack. Now, we talked about the program stack last week when we talked about MIPS. And I talked about this stack of what we call stack frames, which hold, so you create a new stack frame whenever you call a new function, and you store in the stack frame things like the return address and arguments that you want to pass to the function you're calling, and maybe you store some local variables in this stack frame as well. So there's this program stack of stack frames, which also is another storage area for data. And then a third storage area is usually called the static storage area. This is for long-lived data. Usually in the static area, objects live for the whole lifetime of the program. So objects exist there, or data exists there at the beginning of running, and then it lasts until your program eventually exits. In contrast, in the stack, a stack frame is only live for the lifetime of the corresponding procedure call instance that stack frame is associated with. So as soon as you return from some method or some function, then the stack frame that was associated with it goes away. All the data there is forgotten. So that the data on the stack is quite short-lived. Data on the heap is in the middle. When you use this new function, say Java, you allocate a new part of the heap for use of that object that you're just creating. And then in Java, there's this thing called garbage collection. Did you discuss that a bit? So there's this, in Java, there's this reclamation of data that you no longer need on the heap. and that happens behind the scenes automatically. And we'll talk about it more, but in C, that doesn't happen. So those are these three areas. In Java, all objects are on the heap, and we've got this garbage collection to recycle unused heap objects. In C, you have much more explicit exposure to those three areas. And in addition, you don't have garbage collection, so you have to do more management of the heap area than you have to do by hand in your program in Java. Any brief questions on this? So this is still kind of bird's eye overview, just kind of spelling out some differences. All right, pointers. In C, we have a special... we have a way of having talking about variables or having variables in our program which refer to other variables in our program or refer to fields of objects in our program. We've seen the kind of concept, so really these are variables which hold, another way of viewing them is that the variables which hold addresses. They're somewhat similar to the concept of a reference in Java. Now in Java, did you discuss the difference between primitive types and reference types? I see nods, okay. So we'll kind of come back to that distinction a bit later and talk about pointers more, probably next lecture. But yeah, you've seen, when we talk about MIPS, you kind of saw the concept of a variable or a location holding an address in memory of where some other data is actually held. All right, let me show you one of the simplest possible C programs that you could write. So I encourage you to type in this example, and then you've got to run it. So once you've typed this into a file, on the command, say you call that file hello.c, and you can just type gcc, that's calling the GNU C compiler, on hello.c, that compiles it and creates a file called a.out, which contains assembly language instructions for, if you compile on a x86 architecture, it will be for the, there'll be instructions in the x86 ISA. And you can run this program, you can run it just by typing /a.out. So what have we got here? We've got a statement at the top, which is called an include statement. We'll talk about this again later. It's a bit like an import statement. It's telling you, in Java, import statements tell you about other classes you want to use. Here, this tells you about a particular library of functions that you want to use. Here, we're wanting to pull in a library of functions to do with input and output, because we want a program that will write hello world to the terminal. In particular, here we're including declarations of a declaration of this printf function, which does printing. In Java, if you've got a top-level class, you write a main method in that class, and then you can run that main method to get your Java program started. In C, you just have a main function outside a class, not as part of a class. You just have one file which contains the main function. The main function in general can take arguments which correspond to the arguments you type on the command line. Here, if you don't have to take any arguments, you can just put the type void in for the argument list instead. So here we've got a main function. I guess even before that, yeah, we've got two kinds of comments like you've got in Java. This kind and this one-line comments too. This here is not strict C, but almost all C compilers these days support it because it's very useful. Here we've got a print statement, a print command, which is a function procedure imported from here. It's just printing out the phrase hello world. And now we've got a return statement. We return a zero. This is called an exit code. It's a zero says that this program is terminated normally. We return non-zero numbers when we want to indicate back to whoever's running the program that something's gone wrong, usually. All right, so this is a program. When you run it, it will just print out "Hello World," but that kind of shows you how simple or how small a C program can be. We're going to get to C syntax in a bit. I just want to kind of talk about what in the C world kind of corresponds to the notion of class, because you still this kind of concept of group of organizing a program into modules or classes is a very good organization principle, and it's realized in another way to a great extent in the C language. So the idea is that you divide your program into what are called compilation units. And a compilation unit is really the unit of modularity in a C program. Each commonly has a main file and then pulls in what are called header files, or imports these header files, which tell us about the interfaces of other compilation units. So you might pull in a header file which tells you about I/O, as we saw on the previous slide. So each compilation unit is compiled separately, just as in Java you compile each class separately. In the case of compiling a C program, each compilation unit is compiled into what's called relocatable object code. So this is assembly code, but minus the final information about addresses. The idea is that it's assembly code which you could put into different positions in memory at a later stage. And then when you want to run a C program, what you do is you have all your separate compilation units. You compile each one separately. Then you pull together all these relocatable object codes using a tool called a linker. And you pull them into a single block of code called an executable. And then a loader program brings this executable into memory, initializes, say, maybe some data, and then starts running that code. So there are really these three phases in running a C program: compiling, linking, and loading. In the previous example, when you ran GCC, that GCC command was actually doing all three of those things all together. But there are ways of actually teasing out each of those steps separately if you need to. Here's just a brief example of having two compilation units. We've got one called A, one called B. The body of A is in this file a.c. And here's a header file for A. So this, as I said on the previous slide, these header files define interfaces. So they declare functions and variables and types which are defined actually down here in the body of this compilation unit, but which then other compilation units might want to use. So this is like the public interface of this compilation unit, which is actually defined down here. So here we've got a second compilation unit, b.h. It perhaps pulls in a standard I/O header, but then perhaps it pulls in the header for A as well. So the idea is here we've got a unit which is going to make use of the first one, use of the compilation unit A. So here what we're seeing in the C world is kind of how you write in the C world, what you'd be doing in Java if you were creating two classes where the second class was importing and making use of the first class. This is how you do it and do the corresponding thing in C. Just note here that we've got, in this include syntax, we've got two ways of referring to files. We use the angle bracket when we're importing headers which are from a system library, and we use the double quotes when we're importing headers which are local, part of the program you're actually writing. All right, let's now start going through some of the basic features of the C language. So we've got data types. We've got data types with names which look like the names that you have there in Java. And indeed, the data types themselves are fairly similar. So we have a character data type. However, these are 8-bit characters. They're ASCII characters. They're not 16-bit Unicode characters as in Java. We then got these names, short, int, and long, for signed integers. Unlike the case in Java, where the sizes of these are fixed, with different C compilers for different architectures, these data types have different sizes, which is a huge cause of frustration for people trying to write portable C code, but it's just the way things are in C. So typically, these are kind of typical sizes then. A short is typically 16 bits. An integer these days is very rarely 16 bits, commonly 32 bits. If you're running on a 64-bit processor, not just one with a 64-bit address space, but kind of true 64-bit architecture, then ints might be 64 bits. And then longs are, they can be 32 bits, they can be 64 bits. I think on the DICE machines this year, they're 64 bits. Last year, before we switched DICE over to using 64-bit addresses, longs were 32 bits. We then have of the floating point types, floats and doubles, 32 bits and 64 bits, respectively. So, bit sizes are machine dependent, as I said. You have, these are signed integers, 2's complement. These integers up here are all signed. I think characters are signed as well. But you can have unsigned versions of them as well. So if you really want to use every last bit. And you don't have a Boolean type. So instead, what happens in C is you use one of the integer types when you want to have a Boolean value. And the common convention is that numerical value 0 stands for false, and anything non-zero is interpreted as true. All right, so that's your types. Let's talk a bit about variables. So we have what are called global variables. These are sometimes called external variables in C documentation. These are statically allocated. This means they're allocated in this static area of memory, and they have a lifetime of your whole program. They're typically defined at the top level of your compilation unit, not nested inside a function or nested inside a structure declaration. We'll come to what structures are shortly. So I mentioned lifetime. Are you familiar with the term scope? Yes? So scope is kind of where in a program you can refer to some declared entity. So basically, if you declare an external variable at some point in a compilation unit, you can refer to that declared variable from that point to the end of that compilation unit. If you want to refer to that variable in some other compilation unit, there are ways of doing it using what's called an extern declaration, which you put into the header. If you really want to make sure that an external variable cannot be seen by other compilation units, then you use what's called a static declaration. Now, this word static, I should warn you, is an incredibly overloaded word in the C world. It's used for about three or four different senses. So this is just one peculiar to C way in which the word static is used. We then have what are called local variables, automatic variables. These are like in Java, variables that you declare in your functions or in your methods. And typically, these then have a scope just within the method or function itself, and they have a lifetime, which is usually each invocation of a function. So they don't survive between invocations of a function. However, with these, so that means you should gather from that then that they're stack allocated. However, you can declare a local variable to be static. Here's yet another use of static. And in that case, the same storage is used for all invocations of a function. All right, the C preprocessor. So when people wrote the C language, they decided that the raw C compiler wouldn't support some features. Instead, they were going to support such features by a separate program called a preprocessor, which reads in a C program and then outputs a C program again, which the proper C compiler works with. And the C preprocessor then interprets extra special commands in the initial source file. And these special commands are ones which begin with a pound sign. So things like this includes command that you saw before for including header files. That's something that the C preprocessor understands. Other examples of C preprocessor commands are this define here. So this is how you introduce a named constant. So you kind of, hopefully you've been told in Java programming, never sprinkle around constants without names, because one day you'll want to change those constants and you won't know where a given constant is replicated and you won't know what it's about. But if it has a name, then the chances are you've used the same name in many places and you only have to change its definition once. Plus two, maybe the name suggests something about its use. So similarly, you achieve that result using what's called a macro definition for a constant, which looks like this. You can also define what looks a bit like a function here. This is often what we call inline functions. So you can say max of xy is this. And what happens is, textually, the preprocessor replaces every instance it sees of max with something for x and something for y with this expression here. And then this expression here is repassed by the C parser when the C compiler proper runs. This means that this mechanism is tremendously open to abuse and coming up with obscure macro definitions. You can have this right-hand side here make no syntactic sense whatsoever until something else is added on the end of it. So it's a powerful feature, but also a feature that can be infuriating as well if you do much C programming. And what's very useful is conditional compilation. You can have parts of your code which you want compiled sometimes, but not other times. And then you can use these things called ifdef blocks. You can say, here I've got a block of code, and only if the debug macro is set to some non-zero value do I want this code here to be included. So here, for example, you could have a macro called debug, yeah, and only when that's set to true does some debugging message get printed. And it might be that you can actually specify the value of this macro not using a pound define statement, but actually on the command line when you're compiling. So you'd be able to say, compile this program with all the debug statements included when you're debugging, but then when you want maximum performance and you don't want all the debugging error messages, you'll just be able to change the way in which you're compiling the program to exclude all that special code. All right, so let's kind of move on, go back to talking about data. And let's talk about what are called structures, or composite data structures in C, and particularly start with talking about structs. So structures, you can think of as being a bit like objects. However, whereas in Java, an object always belongs to a class, and a class has not only fields, but also has method definitions or declarations. In this C world, a structure does belong to a structure type, and you can define structure types, but structure types are much, much simpler than classes. In particular, they don't have any methods or functions directly associated with them. All they have is declarations of fields. Let's see an example here. So what we have is a definition of a struct which has been given the name point. And we're saying it's got two fields which have int type. The fields have got names x and y. And actually what we've got here is kind of two things in one. We're seeing the definition of the type of struct called points, we're also seeing the declaration of a variable called p1, which is of this struct point type. So things are optional here. When we define the structure, we don't have to also declare a variable here, but we can do. Once we've defined a structure like point, and we wanted to talk about another variable having that type, we can talk about its type as follows. So struct point is the name of a structure type, it's the name of the structure point, and so this whole thing here is a type, and we're saying p2 is a new variable and it has that type. So that's the basics. That's how you declare a structure and how you declare a variable to have, how you declare a structure type and how you declare a variable to have that type. As with objects in Java, you can use this dot notation to access fields or components of a structure. So for example, if we want to set the X field of the structure stored in variable p1, we could just write p1.x equals 2. So that's similar to the way it is in Java. Then, just a mark which we'll expand on later, when you're passing structures between functions, in Java, if you remember, when you've got these class types like A and B, these class types are always reference types. So they're always talking about references. So an element in a reference type is a reference to the object. And so when you pass an object between methods, what you're passing really is a reference to the object which is sitting out on the heap. You're not passing a copy of the object itself. In C, when you pass a structure between functions, you have a choice. You can choose to pass a copy of the whole data in the structure itself, or you can choose to just pass a pointer to that structure, which is actually then out in memory somewhere, out on the heap, or actually maybe out on the stack or out in the static area as well. But in C, the C language gives you more control over the way in which you pass arguments than you have in the Java language. Let's see. I'm going to stop there because I'm going to run out of time, and some of you may have other places to get to. But next week on Tuesday, we'll start again from this slide here. So as I said before, I encourage you very much to have a go at the MIPS programming lab, the kind of online exercise right now. At least fire it up. See how far you get. If you've got questions, ask on the discussion forum, and I'll sort out some labs very shortly and get those timetabled, get the labs reserved, and get us some demonstrators assigned. And I'll email you as soon as that's set up. Thank you. Thank you.